So what shall we talk about today?
Maybe you could talk more with the child I was saying this morning, you know, quoting that verse from the Jesus. The only one who surrenders them to me can, like, overcome this illusory energy, which I myself am creating.
Oh, that was the verse he was quoting. Daivihi esha guna mayi mama maya duracaya. That one. Yeya tamam prapadyante. Yeah, but so Krishna says, Daivihi esha guna mayi mama maya duracaya. That this illusory energy, maya, she is Devi, she is my servitor. Daivihi esha guna maya. Mama Maya, she's my Maya, Duratyaya. And it's impossible to overcome. It's impossible to get out of this illusion. So like so many slokas, the first part leaves us devastated. Oh, then what can we do? We might as well leave, right? She has Krishna saying that it's impossible to get out of illusion. So why try? And why is it impossible? Because she's working under his direction. Maya is an illusory energy, but she's working under the direction of Krishna. So Krishna's like the hypnotist, and Maya is the spell that we're under. If Krishna commands, see me like this, Guru Maharaj is fond of saying, then we are forced to see Krishna like that. And then immediately after that he says, now see me like this. Then we are forced to see him like that. Just as the hypnotist will force you to see something as something else by the power of his illusion, Krishna has us captivated by in an hypnotic trance. And that hypnotic trance is Mayadeva. So because Krishna is the master and his will is supreme and Maya is working under his direction, then yes, it is impossible to get out of illusion. But the second half of the shloka comes to our rescue. Mang eva ye prapadyante mayang itang tarantite. If you surrender to me, O Krishna, I understand that everything I'm seeing is illusion because you are the master hypnotist and you are forcing me to see like this. So now I surrender unto you. And then immediately Krishna is gratified, he removes the illusion. Mang eva ye prapadyante, those who surrender to me, mayang etang now becomes tarantite. Very easy to overcome. In the first half of the verse I said it's impossible to overcome, and it is. But the secret is surrender to me, and immediately that curtain is removed. So we get so much hope, and we see that without Krishna, it's impossible to get out of illusion. But Krishna, of course, means Guru. Who is Krishna? I heard he died 5,000 years ago. Somebody offed him. So that historical personality that walked this earth some time ago is no longer here. Krishna, even if we understand his God, is because he's gone back to wherever his God lives, we can't see him. So what can we see? We can see Gurudev. So Krishna says, Acharyamang Vijaniyam, when you are sincerely seeking me, I actually reveal myself to you through the Guru. Because how can you have a connection with me? It's impossible. But I send my agents, who are none different from me, because they are the authorized agents of the Absolute. They are my bona fide servitors and representatives. So anything you do for them will be as good as having done that for me. And we know that the ambassador for, let's say, the United States when he gives a message to the president of Russia, say, then it's as good as the president speaking and giving that message, because he's the plenipotentiary, he's the authorized agent, he's authorized to act on behalf of the president. So the guru is like Krishna because he's authorized to act on behalf of Krishna. So whenever we hear Krishna saying, like in this verse, only those who surrender to me can overcome illusion, that doesn't really mean Krishna, because where is Krishna? It doesn't exist in our consciousness. But Gurudev exists. I can see him, I can feel him, I can touch him, I can hear him. And so when I want a connection with Krishna, I have a connection with this personality who I can see as the subject, I can see as my teacher, as the guru, and through that personality I will have some real connection with Krishna. And it's the same when Krishna is saying sarva dharman parichaja. How do you surrender to Krishna? Right? Any Krishna that you surrender to is going to be imaginary, something that you concocted in your mind. Yes, Krishna, I surrender to you. What do you want me to do? Oh, eat ice cream and chocolate all day. Yes, I will do that service for you. You're going to surrender to somebody imaginary who's an object of your imagination and who's therefore going to tell you to do whatever it is you want to do because you control him. That can't be Krishna, right? Krishna must be some independent personality. So it's impossible, do you agree, to surrender to Krishna? If you think you've surrendered to Krishna, then you're really a sahaja. You have an imaginary relationship. Sahaja means two things. When we speak about sahaja, we mean sentimental, overly so, mawkishly sentimental, and imaginary. So how can you surrender to Krishna except through your imagination? You don't know anything about him. You've just read some books and you've read some description, but he doesn't exist outside of your imagination. So you'll surrender to Guru because he can make Krishna real. If you really want to see Krishna, you see him through your ear. Gurudev will give you the proper conception how to see Krishna, and you will be able to see him properly. But with your eyes, never. Eye exercise, Acharya Maharaj was reminding us this morning. So surrender to Krishna really means surrender to Guru. It's impossible. Anything Krishna is saying in the Gita, you know, do this for me, do that for me, you can't, right? Patram, pushpam, palam, toyam, one offers me, you know, a leaf, a flower, fruit, water. We don't, because it will be imaginary. So who do we offer this to? Gurudev. Because I have a relationship with Gurudev, but I have no relationship with Krishna, except in my imagination. So we're not interested in anything imaginary, we're interested only in reality. And Gurudev is real. He's here before me, he's instructing me. So whatever Krishna says, offer me fruit, flower, water, surrender to me, all of these things, it really means to my agent, to the Guru. Otherwise it's impossible. You have to understand that. You can never surrender to Krishna. You can never serve Krishna. You can never offer Krishna anything except through your imagination. But Gurudev, yeah, we can do all of these things. He engages us in that service. He tells us how to offer, what kind of leaf Krishna likes, what kind of jal. It's not just regular water, it's Ganges water. It's not just any leaf, it's a Tulsi leaf. He can take us deeper and show us these things. But on our own, everything we do is wrong. So Gurudev is helping to adjust our service, and our service will become perfect if we do everything through the agency of the guru. So don't, when you read anything where Krishna says, do this for me or surrender to me, think that it's him. It really means Gurudev. Otherwise, you risk becoming a sahaja, a sentimentalist. You have to be practical. You have to understand everything that's practical about Krishna consciousness. So don't use buzzwords. Don't just say, dive deep into reality. What does it mean? Die to love. What does it mean? These are aphorisms. Aphorism means something that's been condensed down into its purest form. But that means it can be uncompressed and expanded. Guru Maharaj takes Om, a single syllable, and he pulls out Srimad Bhagavatam from there, from one syllable. Right? He says, first there's Om, and everything is contained there. The entire Srimad Bhagavatam, Radha Dasyam, compressed, zipped into one small file that's just Om. But if you unzip that Om, then you see, oh, there's a folder in there. And that folder is the Gayatri Mantra. And now that has few more syllables than Om, and that is explaining the whole concept. But it's also very compressed, right? Starting and ending with Om, and then inside, Bhur, Bhuvar, etc., taking us up, giving us that Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi, that Srimati Radharani is engaging us in the service of Krishna, that Radha Dasyam conception in a few syllables. And then Narada Muni taking that and speaking 10 verses to Vedavyas, his disciple, and saying, meditate on this. So from Om we've got the Gayatri Mantra, and then we have these 10 verses that Narada Muni speaks to Vedavyas, and then Vedavyas brings out the 100,000 verse Srimad Bhagavatam. So that Bhagavatam is compressed into 10 verses, that's compressed into the Gayatri Mantra, and that's squeezed all into Om. So Guru Maharaj, when he says die to live, when he says dive deep into reality, when he says, what are some of the others? These are compressed like that. And if we extract them, we can draw so much meaning out. So it's useless just to say Om or die to live. You got to know what is it, what is contained in there. If you don't have that practical understanding, it's just some syllable, right? But if in chanting Om, you can draw out that whole Gayatri Mantra as Guru Maharaj explained it, and then from that get those 10 verses that Narada Muni gave to Vedavyas, and from that pull the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, then you have some practical understanding of Krishna consciousness. But if you can't do that, it's just a sound. It's not going to liberate you. But if you meditated on that sound, that single syllable, understanding everything that it meant, and Srimad Bhagavatam really means Radha Dasyam, you can pull all of that out, then you've made some progress in Krishna consciousness. You're actually liberated. So it's a process of knowing how to apply what we've heard and learned practically in our life. What does it mean exactly, these things? If we're just chanting Hare Krishna, it's the same thing, right? They just sounds, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. It just sounds, blank mantras, Guru Maharaj said. The gun without the bullets is making the sound with the blank in it, it's making the bang, but there's no potency, there's no power, there's no actual bullet. But the sound is the same. So when Gurudev is chanting Hare Krishna, he has a particular conception. We know this to be the Radha Dasyam conception. When we chant Hare Krishna, we're just making noise. So we have to try to understand how I can stop making noise and endow my chanting with a little potency. That means we're diving now deeper into reality and trying to apply this practically. If you read Bhagavad Gita and you don't apply those lessons practically to your life, or you think this is Krishna speaking to Arjuna 5,000 years ago, then it's just going to remain a story to you. But if you understand that, no, this is Krishna speaking to me now in April 2010, in whatever country I might be in, whatever city I might be in Moscow, in Los Angeles, or whatever, he's speaking to me now, and what he says is relevant to me now. Then you try to apply that to your life, and you start to make some advancements, because you practically applying the philosophy to your daily life. Unless you're doing that, it's just some abstraction, it's just some entertaining story. So, as you were saying yesterday, the onus is on you to push your own progress through introspection, to constantly push yourself forward by examining what it is you've heard from Gurudev and what it means, how to interpret what Gurudev is giving me. He has asked me to do this. Why has he asked me? What is the lesson to be learned from this? Without that kind of introspection, you'll never make any advancement. I'm guaranteeing, promising you. You'll chant Hare Krishna for 20 years and it will make no difference, because how has your consciousness changed? We're trying to become Krishna conscious. That means we want to change our consciousness from the self-centered, illusory ideas that we have now to embrace reality, to see things as they really are, to become Tattva-darshana, to have the darshan of that Supreme Absolute Reality. And we can only do this by examining our own consciousness. If we're not examining that, how is it going to change? The teacher will give you so many lessons in the class, but you have to do homework to prove to yourself and to her that you've understood the lesson. Right? She gives you on the blackboard, 2 plus 2 is 4, 4 plus 4 is 8, 8 plus 8 is 16. Then for homework, she's going to give you something you haven't heard the answers to. What's 5 plus 3? Now, if you've been paying attention in class to the rules of addition and subtraction, without the teacher's help, you should be able to add 5 plus 3. Even if you use your fingers, say, well, I have 5 here and 3 here. So let me count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You get the right answer. So now you're proving to yourself and to the teacher that you've understood the lesson, because you can solve problems that she hasn't given you the answer to on your own, just using the formulas she's given. But if for your homework you get 3 of the 4 sums wrong, then she can understand that, oh, you haven't been paying attention in class. While she was explaining how you subtract or add, you were looking out the window at the boys playing football on the playground, right? You used to do that. So then it becomes obvious you weren't paying attention. So Gurudev is giving us so much instruction, and our homework is that introspection, where we prove to Gurudev and ourselves that we were paying attention to the lesson, that we have understood what he's saying, and that we can execute these commands that he's given us, or explain his philosophy to somebody else, even if Gurudev hasn't personally told us about that aspect of the philosophy, just using those kinds of formulas. So it's very important that we ourselves test ourselves. Otherwise, how can we make any advancement? And this is one of the things, one of the conclusions you must come to that I'm saying earlier, that when Krishna says, do this for me, do that for me, surrender to me, he can't mean himself. Because we don't know him. We don't have a connection with him. How do we get a connection with Krishna, with reality? Well, that he gives in the fourth chapter, right, where he says, Tadvidhi. Oh, so you want to understand how this process works. You want to know this. You want to get this knowledge. Tadvidhi, then three things you must do. Pranipatena, Pariprajnena, and Sevaya. You must surrender exclusively to my representative. You must not argue with him, but accept implicitly everything that he says, because he's speaking on my behalf. He's my agent, and I am infallible, so don't argue with him. Be submissive and Sevaya. Don't try to utilize this knowledge for yourself, but only for Guru. And that's the qualifications you need. And who should you surrender to? Then Krishna tells you what kind of Guru as well you should surrender to. You should surrender to somebody who's Jnaninas. Guru Maharaj explains this in many different ways, but one of his explanations was somebody who knows the practical and the theoretical. Not just acquainted with some abstract idea, but he has practical experience as well. Somebody who's Jnaninas and Tatvadashina. He sees me directly, interacts with me directly on the plane of reality. That would be the Guru that you surrender to. And if you surrender and submissively ask questions and only for service, then what will be the result? Upadekshanti he jnanam. Your consciousness will be drawn up into that higher plane. Why? Because Gurudev is drawing your consciousness up into that higher plane. And you'll eventually reach the stage where you too have Tattva-darshana, where you too can see me. But that will only come through the agency of the Guru. So Krishna is saying, look, if you want any kind of relationship with me, you have to go through somebody who's Jnaninas, Tattva-darshana. This is my agent. You surrender to him and you'll see me directly. So throughout the Gita, where Krishna is saying, surrender to me, do this, do that, he means to me in my form as the agent, in my form as the Guru. Acharyamang Vijaniyam means I show myself to you through Srila Gurudev. When the soul is most anxious for a revelation, when the jiva, the living entity, is sincerely seeking me, then I will appear before them as the Guru. So that is Krishna. That is our only link with reality. Everything else is imaginary, but the connection with Guru isn't. And then if we follow Gurudev's advice and we execute this in a practical way, not just lip transaction. Right? Surrender is not a lip transaction written on our whiteboard now. What does Guru Maharaj mean? Again, what does he mean? Surrender is not a lip transaction. It sounds nice and people think you're smart when you say that. Right? But what does it mean? It means it's easy. Talk is cheap is what it means. It's easy to say, I surrender to you, Gurudev. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You want to see, are you really surrendered? Or do you say, well, these guys are going, I'm not going anyway. Then obviously you're not very surrendered. Get out of here. Come back when you have a proper mood of surrender. So all of these things we have to examine. And when I examine myself, I see all of these faults, like what I'm saying right now. And I think, you're not even close. But I like to pretend, oh yes, I'm very surrendered. Look, I took sannyas. It's not like that. It's not a lip transaction. It's not, you know, it's not just talk. It must come from the heart and it must manifest itself practically. So all of these things, if we think like that, then we start to think practically. Don't be a sahaja. Don't be a sentimentalist. Don't develop these imaginary relations that don't exist other than in your mind. We want to be serious. We We want a connection with reality, so let's not fool ourselves. Let's try to get that connection, and that means hard work. It means homework every day. But when you were in school, you had homework every day, and you didn't mind because the end result, wow, you minded.
Hang on.
Right. Right, wait a minute. I minded. I wanted to play football, but at the same time, I knew if I didn't do my homework, I wouldn't get a good mark, and then I'd be kept back. In South Africa, they actually kept you back. In America, I think it's impossible to fail.
Like the next year.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That makes you repeat a year.
Yeah, you could repeat kindergarten.
So in Australia.
Yeah. So, yeah. An examination at the end of the year. Right. No, and hardly anybody failed, but I do know two people that failed. I guess they just couldn't get like addition and subtraction, so how can you go to the next class? Right. I mean, it's more than just crayons. You got to sing the ABC. But that was the real risk, that you could fail the exam and then you repeat it. And the 8th grade, which is called Standard 6 in South Africa, because you have Class 1 and Class 2, then Standard 1 and Standard 2. So Standard 2 is actually 4th grade. But a lot of kids would get as far as the 6th grade, and there were just two. 8th grade, and they were just too dumb to go any further. So you had, like, I mean, in one class, there was an 18-year-old guy in the 8th grade, you know, with a moustache and a beard and everything. He just couldn't pass the grade. So you got all of these kids with this big galoot sitting at the desk. Of course, he was the class bully. He could beat us up. So, back to homework. If you didn't do your homework, you know, you lost marks and you could end up failing the exam. So even though I wanted to play football, I do my homework first before playing football. But we tolerated this homework, etc., because we knew it was actually to help us. We could see if we had learned the lesson. And if we didn't, you know, let's say it was something a little more difficult, like long division, and we got 4 of the sums wrong that we had for homework. But still the teacher could say, well, look, because it's long division, you got all of these workings up good right up to here, but you forgot to pay back the one that you borrowed from the 10 into the unit, and that's why you got the answer wrong. So you'd still get marks for all the parts you got right. If the sum was worth 4 marks, say you'd get 3 out of 4. So we try to do our homework and understand where you've gone wrong so that you can correct it and pass the exam. So in our Krishna conscious life, that's going to be a lot harder than going to school and going to university. We should expect to work a lot harder. How much effort do we put in to studying for the exams, etc.? This is going to be our test. And your exam, of course, is death. Right? That's when you get tested. How much do you know about Krishna consciousness? Even a dog knows this. Okay, you can become a dog. But if your consciousness is higher, then okay, you're like an Indra. So go and enjoy with Indra for a few 100,000 years. Depends on you. How much you progress, how much knowledge you've absorbed, how much sukriti you've gained, how much you've understood what is Krishna consciousness. This is your test at the end of life, because now your consciousness will be going up or down to some hellish planet to suffer or to some higher planet to enjoy. So don't neglect your homework. Try to understand what is Krishna consciousness proper. Otherwise, you'll end up in some weird place. If your concept of Krishna consciousness is that Krishna is a nice guy and we go to heaven when we die to enjoy with him, then maybe you'll end up, if you're lucky, in Indraloka, which is far, far, far below Brahma Loka, which is far, far, far below Shiva Loka, which is only on the border area of the spiritual world. And even Vaikuntha, Guru Maharaj describes as the lower hemisphere of the spiritual world. The Krishna consciousness is always practical. Try to have a practical understanding. Every kirtan you go to is not going to be an ecstatic kirtan. Don't get in the habit of using words and phrases like that. Every person who comes to take initiation is not going to be a sincere seeker. Right? But we get in the habit of saying these things and then they lose all meaning. Even our greetings, the ladies say, Dandavat Maharaj. You will never offer your Dandavat as long as you're in Chaitanya Saraswati Math. And of course, the Maharaj has also said, Dandavat. Me too. But it means I'm not thinking, because at the most I might offer my obeisances to you, a lady, but never a Dandavat. So if you mean hello, say hello. Don't say Dandavat. You're using these buzzwords and they lose all meaning. I mean, what does Dandavat mean if I asked you? You can say it, right? You know what it is. Then why are you saying that? Ladies aren't allowed to give Dandavat unless you go Sahaja Indian ladies that roll on the floor and everything. Right? So think about what you're saying and think about what you're doing. Don't get caught up in the buzzwords. It's like, what does Haribol mean? Chant the holy name. But devotees greet each other like that. And before Dandavat, it was the only greeting, right? Haribol, Prabhu. So devotees would call Gurudev. He could always tell when the phone call was from South Africa, he told me. Because they'd say, Haribol, Gurudev. And then once, when we were walking around here, somebody said, Haribol, Gurudev. And Gurudev said, you, Haribol. So imagine you telling your guru to chant the holy name of Krishna. But you didn't mean it like that, right? You meant, hello, Gurudev. But because you don't think about what you're saying, you told your guru to chant the holy name. And he's telling you, no, you chant the holy name. I gave you the mantra, I instructed you to chant, so you chant. How dare you tell me to chant? Anyway, these are just asides, jokes, funny stories, saying if you don't think about it, you can say something like that to Gurudev. And how mortified would you be if in front of everybody you said, you chant Hare Krishna, and you realize what you've done. You know, it's like, nah, duh, how could I be so stupid? So think about everything. We go along with these buzzwords, and I say Dandavat to the ladies all the time. You know, I forget, it's such a habit because everybody does it. But many times I catch myself, and I'll usually say Hare Krishna. And even to the guys most of the time. Yeah, or hello, or hi.
Like, can't we like say the Dandavat, like it's taken on a different meaning.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and even Gurudev would say sometimes, but I'm using these examples just to say, to show you how we can corrupt and pervert a meaning so that it gets some totally different meaning. And this is a very obvious one. But there's so many other things we'll say about Krishna consciousness. And if you're challenged, well, what does it mean, these words that you just said? You can't say it because it's just a buzzword, it's just a slogan.
So we should be at least be prepared to do service to that person if they ask him.
Yeah. You know. But I'm just saying, if you think about things, then at least you have some idea what it is. Because so many people will say, oh yes, you know, Gurudev says, die to live. Well, that's like an oxymoron almost, you know. Die to live, what does he mean? So explain it to me, expand this, you know, talk to me for half an hour about what Guru Maharaj means when he says die to live. You know, most people can't even explain in one sentence. It just sounds nice. They've heard the lecturers say it so many times, but what does it mean? So it's the same thing. What does Krishna mean when he says sarva dhamman paricchaya mangyatam sharanam vraja? It's like, how do I do that? I've never seen him. Well, I know they told me that statue on the altar, that's what they call a deity, is Krishna. So should I serve that? Should I polish the brass every day? Like, what does he mean? You know, who is Krishna? Then through introspection, you'll come to the realization, no, that Krishna can only mean my agent, the guru, is who he's speaking about. Because we have no connection with him. That connection with reality, as I explained, comes through jnanina tatpadasana, through our surrender to a soul who's living on that plane, and that soul is the representative of Krishna. So when Krishna says surrender to me, he really means surrender to Gurudev. It's impossible to surrender to him. We don't know him. We've never seen him and probably never will. Ever. And that is our fortune. Really. So, think about these things. You've read Bhagavad Gita so many times, you should have come to that conclusion that I can't surrender to Krishna. This will be imaginary. So, what does he mean? But I got onto this explaining that Devi hi ashaguna mayi verse. It's the same thing. Krishna says it's impossible to get out of illusion, only surrender to me. And that means surrender to Gurudev. And what happens? Right? Upadekshanti ke jnanam. Our consciousness is revolutionized, it's drawn up into that higher plane of reality. So the illusion all falls away. Om jnana timirandasya jnananjana shalakaya. Why? How do I get out of this darkness of illusion that I was born into? Because Gurudev has removed the cataracts from my eyes. He has made me see the reality. So surrender to Krishna means surrender to Guru. These are basics that you have to understand. But if you've been practicing for 20 years and you haven't figured that out yet, there's something wrong. That means there's no introspection going on in your heart, in your consciousness. Right? You're free to challenge me. I welcome challenges because it will force me to think deeper and present with better analogies, etc., these ideas.
You saying of the misuse of the holy name of the Lord, and talking about the potency of the mantra, Gayatri mantra, Naha mantra, and also we're talking about the surrender to Guru. And my question is, what is the difference between chanting the mantra and receiving it from the Guru? Half of the world can chant Gayatri mantra. You can have even a japa, many people do, and they chant the Naha mantra. But how can they get the potency of the mantra?
They can't. There is no potency. The potency is only coming from Gurudev. Guru Maharaj explains many times that unless you're receiving the mantra from a guru in the authorized line, it has no potency, because what's your connection with reality? I was saying the other day that if before taking initiation you've heard from the devotees and you're becoming attracted to Krishna consciousness and you're offering your food, you know, before you eat an apple you offer it on a picture to Panchatattva, etc. That's nice, but it doesn't have a connection with realities. It's a rehearsal. It's practicing. How can you offer this to Krishna? It's impossible. You can only offer to your guru, who in turn will offer to Krishna. But since you don't have a guru, there's nothing there. There's no potency. But it's a nice thought. And I gave the example, the kids making mud pies. It's impossible to eat. If you offer it to a dad who will pretend to eat out of love for the daughter, he'll take it like this and say, that was very nice, and he drops it behind his back. She's happy, oh, dad ate my cake that I bake, just like moms. So we're making these mud pies before taking initiation. Then once we take initiation, now we have some potency. We're actually using flour and baking powder. And our cake might be a flop still, but at least it tastes like a cake. So the potency only comes with the connection with Guru. And Guru Maharaj, Gurudev tells a story about how Guru Maharaj was giving second initiation to somebody in his room up on the veranda. And then when you give second initiation, typically the Guru will chant these mantras in your ear. And if Guru Maharaj was chanting loud enough, Govinda Maharaj was at the door and there were some people outside, and he told Guru Maharaj, "Oh, they can hear you outside." And Guru Maharaj just said, "I'm not giving to them." So they may hear the words from Gurudev's mouth, Guru Maharaj's mouth, but because he's not giving to them, there's no goodwill there. They can go and repeat it. And even if they were disciples of Gurudev, let's say they were first initiated, they could repeat that. There'll be no potency because Guru Maharaj's goodwill isn't there. You must not only receive the mantra from the Guru, but his goodwill must be there. And then I was telling somebody the story of Karna the other day, right? He was the one who Arjun, the Pandavas' elder brother, of course, but they didn't know, and fought on the side of Duryodhana in the Mahabharata, in the war of Kurukshetra. But knowing that this fight was coming and how powerful Arjuna was, they were all stocking up on different weapons, and Karna went to perhaps Parashuram, who was a Brahmin, and he got this astra from him. I hope I'm getting the names right. He got this powerful astra. He learned the mantra because this he could kill Arjuna with. But because he got it under false pretenses, Karna was a Kshatriya and he disguised himself as a Brahmin in order to learn from Parashuram. Then one day when his guru wanted to take rest, there was nowhere to rest his head, so he put his head on Karna's lap and fell asleep. Of course, this is all Leela, right? So this worm, who's actually Indra, who's actually Arjuna's father, he wants to expose this guy. So he takes the form of this, I don't know what kind of worm it is, that bores its way all through from the bottom, all through the thigh of Karna. And Karna, because he's a Kshatriya and strong, he can tolerate this excruciating pain, and he doesn't want to move his leg because his guru is resting his head there and asleep. So he tolerates this. But the worm bores all the way through, and then the blood running down his leg, his thigh, wets Parashuram's ear. And he wakes up. What is this? He sees his blood. Where does this blood come from? This worm has bored through your thigh and you didn't wake up. Why didn't you wake me? Oh, I didn't want to disturb you. And then Parashuram realizes that this guy must be a Kshatriya. No Brahmin could endure that kind of pain. Then he confronts him, Karna confesses, and then his guru says, "Because you have deceived me, when you most need this mantra to cast this weapon, you will forget it." And of course it happens. There's poor Karna, he's riding near the end of the war, his chariot gets stuck, he jumps down to pull the wheel out in the mud. Krishna tells Arjuna, "Kill him, come for him," and he's trying to protest, "Hey, this is not abiding by the laws of the Kshatriya code," and Krishna chastises him. "You've ignored the Kshatriya code in all of these instances, now you're going to tell us that?" And he wants to throw that astra that he's learned, but of course at that time of necessity, the greatest necessity, that curse comes into effect and he can't remember it. Poor guy. I mean, he's such a... I like him. I always feel so sorry. Yeah, and he should have been the ruler. When Yudhisthira finds out, he says, "I will, because you are the eldest son, really, I'll make you the king." But by then he's too loyal to Duryodhana. So like, yeah, I always feel so sorry for this guy. But that was one of the things. So Guru Maharaj used that example to show that even if you got the mantra from the Guru with the goodwill, but the Guru later withdrew that goodwill, then that mantra is useless. Everything depends on the Guru's goodwill. And we... It's very scary. But we know of instances even within our time and life where Guru has requested that the beads be returned. Right? We know of some cases where some unfortunate person has become so offensive that Gurudev has wanted the beads back. So if you don't send them back and you continue to chant, or you send them back and you get some other beads and chant, there's no potency there. You might as well not chant. You're really wasting your time. Without that goodwill of the Guru, which can be withdrawn at any time, that mantra has no potency. So all of these people that are chanting Hare Krishna, there's nothing there. If you were in another society and you saw that and that person said Hare Krishna, then you think, oh, this goat for sure is going back to Godhead because the guy chanted Hare Krishna. It's not like that at all. There's no potency at all. You might as well have chanted Coca-Cola to have the same effect. Seriously. Not joking. So that potency only comes from Guru, and the Guru typically will only give you that connection if he's pleased with your level of pranipatina, your level of sincerity and surrender. If he's pleased with your submissiveness in and your non-argumentative mood in hearing what he has to say, and if you utilize that knowledge that he's giving you for his service, then he connects you with reality. But if at some time he becomes displeased with you because you're not doing any of these things or going against his order, he can withdraw that goodwill, and then all of those mantras have no effect. So from just some of these examples of Guru Maharaj saying, I'm not giving them these dietary mantras, and these other examples, you can see that the goodwill of the Guru is all important, and without that, it's nothing.
I would kind of bring myself to say that, like when I have all these good chanting of the name of Krishna, like air.
Right. The Mayavadi is like thunder against the body of Krishna, like lightning bolts against the body of Krishna, and so many things. And Guru Maharaj stresses many times that the Mayavadis also chant Hare Krishna, but what is their conception of Krishna? They are using Krishna as a stepping stone. They're standing on Krishna's head and using him as a stepping stone to become God. Right, to merge into the cosmic consciousness, the Brahma Jyoti, which means they will be God. The Brahma Jyoti is the rays from Krishna's body. It's an impersonal thing. And you're committing suicide because it's a non-differentiated consciousness. When you merge into the cosmic consciousness, you can't retain any individuality. It's a universal consciousness. So if all of us merged into just this single consciousness, we can't be aware of our individual identities because it's a group consciousness. And Guru Maharaj describes that this is like a deep but very pleasant sleep. So you asleep and it's very pleasant and warm and comfortable and blissful, but you're not aware of that you exist because you are asleep. You know, and at some very slight level, you know that this is cool because it's pouring with rain or it's snowing outside and you're in this nice warm house and you're sleeping, and so you're feeling warm and comfortable, but you don't have any consciousness of your individuality because you're asleep. So it's something like that. It's pleasant, but without any identity. So they are chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and it's taking him there. And we are chanting Hare Krishna, but it's taking us to Goloka Vrindavan because that is our Guru's conception. And then elsewhere, Guru Maharaj explains that if you take initiation from a Ram Bhakta and you get the same Hare Krishna mantra from him, everybody's chanting this mantra. But you cannot go higher than your Guru, so you won't go higher than Ayodhya in the Das level of consciousness. And if you take initiation and receive the mantra from a Vishnu Bhakta, then your highest attainment will be Vaikuntha. So it's like that. Everything depends on the conception of the Guru and the goodwill with which he's giving it. You can't go higher than the Guru. So if your Guru is giving you a Radha Dasyam conception, then that you have the potential to go to that destination, as long as you always have the goodwill of your Guru. So it's something like that. They may chant, but there's really no potency there. Our chanting, because it's connected with reality, and we should also have some practical understanding of that, then it becomes real. So the child can sing A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and you say, oh, he knows his ABCs, but he doesn't, he just knows the song. Now you know that A, you know, has a phonetic sound associated with it, and that's F, right? And if you put these sounds together, the C which has a K sound, the A which has a F sound, and the T which has a T sound, and you pronounce those syllables, K, F, T, then you can read a word that you didn't know the meaning of just by sounding the syllables. D, A, G, Da, A, G, Da, A, Da. Right? Then you pleased with yourself. You run, Mom, Mom, look, I can read this word. It's dog. Because you know how to apply the, you know how to associate the sound with this, with the symbol and read the word. But so somebody chanting ABC and somebody who can actually read, there's two very different levels of consciousness. Somebody chanting Hare Krishna just for the nice sound, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, you know, chanted some good rounds today, that's just some noise that they make it. But if you, when you're chanting, you understand that Hare means Srimati Radharani, Hare, really. That we are worshipping Hari Hara. So Hare Krishna means Radha Krishna. And that Ram doesn't mean Balaram or Dasarathi Ram, but it means Radha Ramana Ram. He who is giving pleasure to Srimati Radharani. He who is giving Raman pleasure to Srimati Radharani. We have that conception. Then obviously our consciousness is going to end up on a vastly different plane than somebody who's just singing the ABC song, who's just singing this, chanting this mantra with no conception. How is his consciousness going to be changed or elevated to that plane? So we must receive it from Guru, we must have the goodwill of Guru, and through introspection we should try to understand what is Gurudev's conception. Why has he asked me to chant this? What is the effect of chanting this mantra? How will my consciousness be elevated? Are there any do's and don'ts that go along with this mantra? Are there any offenses that should be avoided? Are there any prerequisites like humility, tolerance and respect? All of these things, through introspection, we come to understand the potency of the mantra, and the mantra will be more effective because it's raising our consciousness through our own introspection. And then of course the mantra, don't forget, has power on its own, but we can't tap into that power, we can't draw out that power without the goodwill of Gurudev and our own introspection, our own raising of our consciousness. The mantra is trying to raise our consciousness, we have to see how. We have to help it along.